Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, April 4th. I'm Ray Graff. Time once again for another edition of the Science Forum. The experts are here. They're ready to go to answer your scientific questions. The number is 800-348-2551 if you have one. 800-348-2551. You may also email your questions to voxpop@wamc.org. voxpop@wamc.org. Or call 800-348-2551. A full house of scientists here, and they'll answer your questions, hopefully, coming up after the news. Why, hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop. That's our afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Today, we reconvene the Science Forum, and we have had an interesting chat for the last 8 minutes here in Studio A, none of which will go on the air. But if you have a science question, oh, by all means, 800-348-2551 is the number, 1-800-348-2551, or you can email us, voxpop@wamc.org. The eclipse is coming, of course. We already have questions about that in the queue, but you can ask about anything you want, 800-348-2551, or email voxpop@wamc.org. With all that being said, let's have our team of scientists sign in, please.
Hello, it's Barbara Brabetz. I'm a biochemist, and I teach at SUNY Cobleskill.
Roger Giuboni, and I'm an electrical engineer, and I own a company called Rogers High Fidelity.
Jim Pickett, I'm an organic chemist, mostly retired.
Ed Stander, and I'm not retired. I teach geology and astronomy, environmental science, and anything that nobody else can cover.
Well, I'm so glad you all made it in today. There were some bad weather in parts of our listening area and parts of where you live. So great to have you here, and I appreciate it very much. The eclipse is coming up. We talked about it a lot during the astronomy show last week, but we will have some questions about that. Anything anybody wants to talk about before we get into that?
I'm excited about the eclipse, and we've had a few during my adulthood, but I think the number that I'm going to see between now and the end of my foreseeable life is dwindling, and so it's nice to be able to wish for good weather and something close by.
Well, so, I mean, there's another one coming up. You just have to drive to Florida.
Yeah, right. I mean,
a couple few years.
And I need time off or something, yeah.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, well, I always thought it's really very exciting to see an eclipse, and I remember Edmund Hillary, when he got to the top of Everest, being asked, why did you do it? He says, because it's there. The nice thing about the eclipse is that you go to see it because it's not there.
Oh, that's deep. That is profound.
I'm doing my best.
Thank you very much. You brought your A game, and you said during the newscast you'd love just once to be able to do the news reporter close, so it would be blank WAMC News. Go ahead, Ed. Go ahead.
No, can we do it later?
I want to
hold on to it.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because you only get to do it once.
I know, but I'm looking forward to it.
The number here is 800-348-2551. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. James in Kingston writes, do other planets in our solar system experience solar eclipses?
Well, in order to have a solar eclipse, you have to have a moon. And if you have a planet like Jupiter or Saturn or Uranus and Neptune that have 17 or 23 moons, you probably have eclipses all the time. The only trouble is that you can't see them.
Can another planet cause an eclipse?
Well, yes. Well, we can have other eclipses on the Earth. For example, a couple of years ago, Venus was eclipsed. And so we watched actually what's called the transit of Venus.
Yeah.
But it doesn't really eclipse anything because Venus is so small in the sky compared to the sun.
But you can look at, there are pictures, for example, of Jupiter or Saturn and mm-hmm. their moons. And there will be black shadows on the planet. So that's total eclipse.
Yeah, we're just fortunate that our moon is at the apparent diameter to just about match our sun, which is kind of a sweet spot to give us that eclipse. If our moon were teeny tiny in comparison, well, it is teeny tiny, but in comparison to the apparent size of the sun, then we wouldn't get the same eclipse.
Yeah,
it's like two dimes fitting right on top of each other. That's what's so cool about it.
Incredible. Isn't that amazing?
It's a coincidence.
It's the sun is X number of times bigger than the moon, but the moon is X number of times closer.
400. And there will be a time
400.
In the distant future in which there are no longer total eclipses on them.
But the moon is
The dinosaurs had much better eclipses than we did.
Really? Longer totalities?
Longer. Yep.
That's exciting.
But with this other, I saw a really cool video of on Mars of one of its moons basically transiting the sun.
Oh, yeah.
So partial eclipse.
From the Explorer?
Yeah. As the moon whizzed
by. But
they're
so small, you don't really get a good eclipse.
No. It doesn't get dark. But.
Right. And on the astronomy show, Bob Berman, of course, saying, listen, there's nothing like totality. You got to see it. 98% is not good enough.
Yeah. No, 99% is not even good enough.
When we had the last eclipse that was partial here back in 2017, I believe.
Yeah.
The thing that's still cool is the shadows that are cast as the eclipse begins. You get these kind of half moon or crescent-shaped shadows that really appear. And I guess we don't really think about the way that shadows appear under normal sunlight, but when you see it differently, it kind of like sets your mind to, ooh, that's different. That's not how it usually is. And so even without totality, you can still get some coolness
there. Yeah, there was a really good annular eclipse here in the early 80s. And that was just amazing, seeing that projected through the trees.
Yeah. I remember that from the early 90s, another one very similar. It's kind of freaky to see.
Here's something to look for when the eclipse occurs. I was mentioning this to Barbara before, is that when the eclipse reaches about 15% totality, the temperature change on the Earth is enough that the clouds start disappearing.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because the dew point actually changes as a result of the temperature change caused by the sun. And if you have cumulus clouds, for example, they all start going away.
So if we hit partly cloudy skies before the eclipse, there's a good chance you'll see the whole thing.
That's right.
Fingers crossed.
Yeah.
I think the weather's going to be okay. Maybe.
The weather's looking okay. Yeah, and it's probably most particularly like the cumulus clouds that come up in the afternoon during the summer. Those would disappear.
The number to call here is 800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum, and let's see here. This is from Alice. I think I remember learning that one of the sources of the Earth's wind comes from the Earth's spinning on its axis. What are the other influences on winds, such as what some of us are experiencing during the storm today? That's from Alice.
It's primarily temperature changes on the surface of the Earth, and they cause large air mass movements, and that's what creates the wind.
And even more so is barometric pressure. If you have high pressure in one place and low pressure in another place, then the wind is going to go from the high pressure to the low pressure to try and balance it out.
Yeah, and what the spin of the Earth actually does is to make the winds go, depending on the locality,
direction.
East and west mostly rather than north and south.
Right.
If the Earth did not spin, the winds would just be north and south.
From the Coriolis effect.
Interesting. Yeah.
And when you get up in the morning, if you're, you know, we're people that get up and walk the dogs early in the morning. If you get wind conditions in the morning, largely attributable to the air mass movements, not temperature changes on the surface of the Earth, typically means, you know, on the backside of a cold front, you're going to get a fair amount of wind.
And, of course, we have distributions of terrestrial versus marine environments around the planet, and that, too, can create a lot of differences just because of the relative humidity differences and the differential heating of water versus land.
All right. Let's do another astronomy question since we're all here for that. John writes, not sure if this would be better for Bob and Valerie. That's okay. We have a team of brilliant
I'm
folks.
Here.
Yeah, and Ed. What are the speeds of the particles, planets, stars, galaxies, etc., measured relative to? What about the speed of light? With everything moving and expanding, there are no fixed points in the universe. And that's from John.
Well, you measure things with respect to where you are. For example, do you know how fast the moon is going to be traveling, the moon's shadow on the Earth? It's going to be about 2,240 miles an hour. And we know that because we're measuring it with respect to a fixed object, which happens to be the surface of the Earth. So any measurement of time or space is related to a fixed location.
Yeah. And you generally choose whatever it is that's convenient. Like, for example, the motion of the sun in the Milky Way, you would measure relative to the center of the Milky Way.
All right.
And then the motion of the planets in the solar system, you would do relative to the
sun.
To the sun as a fixed point, even though it's not fixed.
But they also do measure speeds as fractions of the speed of light. So radio transmission is a good example. It's depending on the medium it's going through, it's a fraction of C, you know, a fraction of the speed of light.
Right.
And if you want an absolute measurement, if you will, then you measure by Doppler shift.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
And that's from the center of the universe, or
that's from everywhere at once.
There's no center.
There's no center of the universe. So,
for example, right now the Earth is moving towards the constellation Hercules, and we know that because we get a blue shift in the direction of Hercules and a red shift perpendicular to it, or excuse me, 180 degrees from there.
And the reason is the blue is at the higher end of the frequency spectrum because you're compressing the waves, so the period between the waves is getting shorter. And the red shift is because you're moving further away from the source and the period between the waves is getting longer. So.
And yet I understand that everything in the universe is moving apart.
No. Some things are moving apart. Some things are moving together. It depends how much gravity there is.
But the universe continues to expand. Space itself continues to expand. Yeah. How can things get closer if... The entire universe is expanding.
It depends how much things are being affected by gravitational attraction. For example, we're in a group of galaxies that are all moving towards each other simply because there's a gravitational effect there that's making it happen. So it all depends on how far away you are from everything else.
And then closer in, what holds us together are forces much, much stronger than gravity even. So... our molecules, our atoms, are not expanding.
That's why we're not getting bigger.
Wow. I just brought Easter candy in, so we might be expanding by the end of the day.
All right, let's take a break here.
Get a redshift going on.
800-348-2551 is our number. It's the Science Forum. We'll be back. All right, bonus points for our scientists here. Anybody tell me who's playing tenor sax there?
Miles Davis.
That's a terrible guess, Roger. Terrible. No, Coleman Hawkins, right? Everybody, Barb, you knew that.
Of course.
Number here is 800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum on WAMC. You can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Already, let's go to Nancy in Schenectady. Nancy, you're on.
Hi. From various conversations, I've gotten the idea that there's a lot of difference of opinion on the use of the eclipse glasses from the people who think you shouldn't even go outside without having the eclipse glasses on, to people who figure it's only if you really intend to look directly at the sun. And if you're not going to look directly at the sun, you can go outside. You can go whether it's 100%, 97%, or whatever visibility of the eclipse you've got. You don't need the eclipse glasses on unless you're going to look directly at the sun. I'd like to have an expert opinion on how... what's the actual fact on use of this eclipse glass?
Gotcha, Nancy. Ed, why don't you handle this?
Yeah, I can tell you that I usually go outside without eclipse glasses on.
You mean during the regular day?
During all the time.
Oh, when it's sunny.
You were wearing a mask when you came
in
here.
So as long as you're not looking at the sun, then you don't have a real problem.
Yeah.
And basically, the question comes when there's an eclipse— and you're close to 99%, for example, blocked out, is it safe to look at the sun without eclipse glasses? And the answer there is no. You really have to have the moon totally covering the sun. Then you don't need eclipse glasses to look at it during that period. But the rest of the time, if you're going to look at the sun, eclipse glasses are a good thing to have on.
Really is true. Really is true. And don't look at it without the proper vetted glasses. You don't want to mess around, Nancy. Then you go blind and stuff.
Yeah, you only have two eyes, and it's expensive to get new ones. So why chance it?
Well, you can look at it with just one eye, but make sure you have your glasses on.
that's a good point. All right, thank you. For those who can only see out of one eye, do they have eclipse monocles?
They're half the price.
There you go. Thank you. I set you up.
Slightly irregular.
800-348-2551 is the number. Yes, the science crew is here. hilarious as ever. Let's go to Kathleen in Saratoga Springs. You're on.
Hi. This is probably a dumb question, but I've heard so much discussion about not using binoculars and the eclipse glasses that apparently the magnification can damage the glasses and actually create damage to your eyes. So what I'm wondering about is, what about if you have glasses to correct your vision? Can you put those on first and then the eclipse glass over that? And does it matter if they're bifocal or Verilux? And also, if you're standing inside a building looking out through a window, does that have any impact on the protection from the eclipse glasses?
Okay.
Well, let's see. If you need prescription glasses, they can go on top of or below the eclipse glasses, and it makes no difference whatsoever. Binoculars, what you're doing is you're taking the light from a large area and focusing it on a smaller area. And that's the reason why it's not a good idea, unless you cover it up with a much thicker piece of Mylar, for example, or eclipse material. The light from a windows do absolutely nothing as far as blocking the UV rays that are coming from the sun, really.
And you can always make the pinhole cameras, right?
Outside wearing the glasses.
If you look online anywhere, you can see these kind of projects for homeschooling or whatever to make a pinhole camera. So if you really want to stare at it without the glasses, the way to do it is to make the little projection box.
Well, I did that
for
the last one.
Yeah, really well.
Yeah, that was cool.
And you don't even need anything elaborate.
Just piece of cardboard.
Punch a hole in a piece of cardboard and let it project on the ground.
And
it'll work just fine.
It used to be that people would use telescopes and do the same thing. They would put a piece of white paper on the bottom of the telescope so that they would actually project the sun onto the piece of white paper from the telescope. You can do that with binoculars, too, if you want to have a bigger image.
Now, Kathleen, I just want to let you know that there is a website, and I think it's AAS.org. I think that's the American Association of Astronomers or something like that. Anyway, there is a whole series of pages on how to safely look at the eclipse, and I'm pretty sure it's AAS.org. It's really important that everybody who is going to look at this eclipse make sure that they have taken the proper precautions and have the proper gear. You only get one shot, you know, don't mess it up.
I don't know why anyone hasn't suggested just pointing your Ring camera towards the sun.
I think, you know, we did a show last week, and Dr. Valerie Rapson said that they did a demonstration, and I think it's on the SUNY Oneonta website, where they, I think, took their telescope and pointed it at the sun and then had a cow eye and in the path of this thing, and it just burned.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of danger involved.
And the ring camera removes that. I mean, if you hold the ring camera up to watch the sky
and then just watch it
on your phone.
Yeah.
Well, according to the astronomers last week, you can actually toast the chip in your phone doing that too. But I don't know about that. Honestly, I don't know.
Well, I've also seen a lot of notices from New York State government that says that they're worried about the cell phone signal network being overwhelmed by people transmitting these images back and forth too. So it may be more of a broadband issue than it is.
And really, it's a question for Ed. Is there any real reason to look at the eclipse through binoculars or a telescope? I mean, what is the average person going to get out of that?
Well, they're going to see effectively the same thing that they see without the binoculars. So it's
exactly.
Not a major problem.
Kathleen, thanks for the call.
Yeah.
You know, at SUNY Oneonta, where Dr. Rapson holds forth, they have filters on the telescope.
Yeah.
You have that at your house? All right, we'll be over at your house.
Well, actually, SUNY Cobleskill is going to broadcast the telescope image from campus. I mean, we're not totality, but...
Cool.
Yeah.
So you'll be able to sit in a dark room and watch the eclipse.
On a computer screen. Right, just the way most astronomers are going to do it, actually.
Oh, boy. Let's go to Chris in Housatonic. Chris, you're on.
Yeah, I got a question for you.
Okay.
Maybe someone can answer this for me.
Sure.
When I'm outside looking at, like, vapor trails in the early morning, a red. And then when I look at the nighttime or coming over from seas, the jet trails black. Is there any reason for that?
Well, in the morning, they look red because of the redness of the sunrise and the sunset.
Right.
It's for the same reason when you get spectacular sunsets, for example, or I imagine same thing sunrise, but I'm rarely up early enough to see that. what you're seeing is the reflection of the light that's directly transmitted through the thick atmosphere as the sun is setting. The blue light is scattered away, so what it is primarily is red light that's getting through the atmosphere then and turning the clouds red.
And of course, it's higher up than you are, so it gets more light because from its apparent position, it's actually in contact with the light more.
So even when the sun's over, you know, past the horizon, those high clouds get the light. And because the sun is so low, it's pretty much only the red light that gets through.
All right, Chris, thanks a lot for the call. It's the Science Forum today. Ed Standard, Jim Pickett, Roger Jaboni, and Barb Rabbits join us. The number is 800-348-2551. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. Here's an email question. Here's a geology question. Would one of the scientists, and I think I know which one, please explain the geologic situation at Yellowstone National Park? Is there potential volcanic eruption coming?
Yellowstone Park is over the top of what's called a hot spot or a mantle plume. And what that is, it's a body of hot material which is coming from the core of the Earth, working its way through the mantle to the crust. And the crust itself in that area is only about 30, 35 miles thick. It's not very thick. So you have this really hot stuff coming up underneath. And what happens is the crust actually moves over the top of this hot spot. And so from Yellowstone all the way down towards Washington, there's a whole series of places where there used to be volcanoes. When there are no volcanoes there anymore, the hot spot is now over Yellowstone. And so that's the place where effectively the ground is rising up to some extent. And sooner or later, if we're not lucky, it'll actually burst forth and we'll have what's called a supervolcano.
It's going to happen eventually, right?
It might. It might not. It depends on how long it takes and whether that the crust moves over the top of it fast enough. It's similar to ironing some sheets. If you're ironing over an area, then nothing's going to happen. If you iron and then put the iron down on it, you'll wind up burning it. And the same thing happens with this. So there is evidence that it is rising, but at the same time, the crust is moving over the top, so it may not happen or it may. It's happened in the past. The reason Yellowstone is called Yellowstone is because it's covered in a huge amount of volcanic ash.
Now, have these so-called supervolcanoes happened in recorded history?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah? When's the most recent one?
The most recent supervolcano? I don't know. I couldn't tell you.
No, Vesuvius was not one.
No, these are not supervolcanoes.
But I don't. I mean, the prediction is there's no imminent eruption expected from Yellowstone, as far as I know.
But how can you be sure?
Well, I mean, you're never sure.
It usually gets very hot before it happens. And we do have hot springs there that are releasing a lot of the heat. So with any luck at all, the thing will cool off and nothing will happen.
Yeah. And probably there'll be a lot of upthrust, right,
before it happens. There is upthrust happening.
Yeah, but the rate would increase.
Yes.
The number to call here is 800-348-2551 if you have a science question, 800-348-2551, or email us at voxpop@wamc.org. And Marion is in West Hurley, New York. Marion, you're on.
Hello, thank you.
Hi.
I was concerned about one of the scientists said that he would walk around even in daylight when the sun was bright. And a lot of us have to use sunglasses because it's too bright. Mm-hmm. But one show you had talked about beta rays, which come in at a lower elevation.
I don't remember that.
Could be UVB rays?
There you go.
Yeah.
Instead of UVA, UVB, UVC?
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah. And one morning, August 9th, 2021, I went out my front door, and the rays came in from the side, of my eyeball and affected my retina.
Huh.
And then and at first it caused all these swirling black figures, and then I still have peripheral, but I don't have, you know, it depends.
Well,
so I was curious about that, because if you, the rays can come in, like if your sunglasses, you have sunglasses on, they can come in from the side. There are some sunglasses that have, you know, coverage on the sides.
Yeah. The if what you're talking about is UVB.
Or C.
Well, there is no UVC in natural sunlight.
Exactly.
The UVB is most intense when the sun is toward overhead, when it's high in the sky. There's very little UVB when the sun is low in the sky.
Mm.
But that if the sun is low in the sky, the amount of visible light can be very high.
Uh-huh.
And yeah, okay. Presumably that could have affected the eye.
I'm remembering this, the UAV. Go ahead, Marion.
My birthday was August 8th.
Oh, congratulations.
Before, and she took a picture because she was into, you know, getting up at sunrise and taking photos, and it was my birthday. So she took a photo of the morning of my birthday, and the light was so intense.
Yeah.
There's nothing that's fluctuating that would make sunlight especially intense.
Okay. I remember where that conversation came up when we had Dr. Perlmutter, who's a dermatologist, on. And we were talking about sunburn and the UVA, UVB, et cetera, et cetera. So thank you, Marion, for that one. 800-348-2551 is the number. It's the Science Forum today. Jim Pickett, Roger Duboni, Barbara Brabets, and Ed Stander are here to answer your questions about anything under the sun or even at the sun.
But isn't it fair to say that during this period of the eclipse, there's no additional new radiation from the sun?
No.
Right. That's fair.
That's less radiation
right.
from
exactly.
the sun. That's the whole
exactly.
point.
Exactly.
Right?
So it what cold. It does is it allows the eye to look at the blacked out portion of the sun more comfortably while the ring around it still contains the same amount of energy and can therefore damage the eye.
That's
there's no
the
new radiation here.
Right.
Exactly.
So, you know, the concept of additional rays or additional UVA or UVB, None of that is a concern here.
Yeah, it's really about our behavior.
It's our behavior.
It's not the sun's behavior.
The blacked out portion of the sun makes it more. Normally, you wouldn't go out your front door and stare at the sun. Okay, so the blacked out sun makes it a little more comfortable, while the ringed edge is still doing the damage that's staring at the sun.
Make sure you have
exactly.
the right glasses.
Right.
That's
exactly.
all I can say.
The other part of that is that it's much more interesting to look at the sun when the moon is partially covering it, which is why people do it during the eclipse. That's
yeah.
why you really have to be careful.
You know, Valerie, Dr. Rapson brought in some of these authenticated and true eclipse glasses, but
mm-hmm.
they look like little glasses you might get at a 3D movie theater. But I put one on. Man, you can't see a thing, basically.
Welder's glasses.
Yeah, it's amazing. All right, let's go one more call here, and then we'll take a break, and then we'll hit the home stretch on the program. 800-348-2551. Jim is in Adams. Jim.
Yay, Ray.
Hello.
Yay, panel.
Hey.
Yes, I thought I caught someone mentioning there might be the next solar eclipse might be visible from the state of Florida in the United States. When is there
2044.
2044. Make your reservations
now. Yeah. Oh, my God. Anything in less time that's going to be visible from the United States?
There's going to be one in New York in 2079, and then there's one in 2144, if you want to wait for that one.
Jim, do you got a shot? You're 80, right? So you might make it.
Right. nothing in recent in the near future that we can see from the United States.
Well, here's an interesting fact, is that if there's an eclipse in an area, the next eclipse in that same series will occur 18 years, 11 and one-third days later.
Wow.
So this eclipse will have another eclipse 18 years, 11 and one-third days later, and it's going to occur one-third of the way around the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
So if you know when one occurs, you can find out when the next one occurs.
All right, Jim.
Okay.
Well, thanks a lot, man. Appreciate the call. Let's take a break. 800-348-2551 is our number. 800-348-2551. Science Forum. We'll be back. Mike the Cat. That's New York Stories. Danny Gatton wrote that one. Love it. 800-348-2551 is the number. It's the Science Forum today with Barbara Brabets, Roger Jaboni, Jim Pickett, and Ed Stander. And let's do a couple of emails here before we go back to the phones. This is from Al in Newburgh. Are air flights going to be delayed by the eclipse? And if you're on a flight, what will you see?
Well, from what I've read, the delays will be more about the congestion on the ground than it will be the congestion in the air. So having some people who work in the airline industry, I know that often it's more about what's going on the ground, the weather, people getting to the airports on time and all that. But as far as air traffic control goes, same as usual. Again, they're going to warn people about looking outside the plane at the eclipse. Because, again, they're not necessarily going to be wearing the proper glasses.
And there are actually pilots who are charging, I believe it's $2,000 a pop, to go above the clouds if there are any to see the eclipse.
Ah.
So well.
There will be planes up there, there's no question.
This is public radio. We don't give prices. All right. This is from Curious in New Paltz. Yeah, exactly. Keep it ballpark. There's a pretty well-known spot on the side road in the northern part of the Lower Peninsula of Michigan where you can pause and put your car in neutral, and there's a force that pulls you up a hill. I've been there and done it both forward and backward. What gives? Curious in New Paltz.
Dear Curious, I love these questions about geology. It's so rare. What happens in those places is that the rocks are tilted, and they're tilted in such a way that it makes the road look like it's actually tilted the opposite direction that it actually is.
It's an illusion.
It's an illusion.
Right.
Isn't there a mystery spot somewhere down in Woodstock?
Or yes, there is. And there's a place called Owl Creek Canyon, for example, out west, where you're driving along and the water is going uphill.
Oh, cool.
As you're driving. And it's because the rocks are tilting just the right way, so it appears that you're actually going uphill when you're not, or downhill when you're actually going
so
uphill.
So it's all an illusion. Yeah.
So Curious needs to bring a level next time and
exactly.
Put the level on the ground
right
and then
right
think about how the eye is deceiving and the level is telling the truth.
So cool.
Well, it's common if you're driving in the mountains, you'll swear that you're driving
flat
yeah. when you're going uphill or downhill and that the streams are running the wrong way.
Mm-hmm.
All right, this is from Yvonne. Is there a greater chance of clouds forming Monday afternoon due to the mountains of the Adirondacks or over water bodies like Lake Champlain? Here in the Berkshires, we often start the day cloudless, but by noon, it's cloudy due to the air masses passing over the mountains. Can the Science Forum offer any insights into which topography would be less likely to form clouds due to air currents and condensation, assuming Monday begins clear?
Temperature and dew point. It's the only time a cloud forms, when the temperature equals the dew point.
So the meteorologists have been having a field day with us caring about looking up for the first time in a long time. And I read an article about the greatest chance. This was regardless of the weather, but just looking at the historical record, where is it most likely within New York State anyway to get a clear sky? And it was the southern shore of Ontario. Lake Ontario. So kind of from Rochester and wherever the zone of totality hits there on over to, say, Watertown. So that's about it. That's the best you're going to get in New York. I looked, I have a friend of mine who lives in Seattle who's flying to Texas today to be able to go spend the weekend in Texas. And there's going to be, there's a tornado watch, I think, for the day of the eclipse. So
yeah, I think Bob Berman's going down there too.
Oh gosh.
A bunch, so.
Right. So I think New York might just be a winner, winner, chicken dinner on this one.
Winner, winner, chicken dinner?
Well, that's winner, winner, eclipse dinner.
It's a scientific term, and we'll discuss it later.
I got to go back to school.
All right. Let's see here. We got a lot of questions about eclipse glasses. And again, I recommend you go to that astronomy. Is it AAS.org? Did anybody check that?
I checked it. It's AAS.org.
Okay, go there.
Also, the New York State Museum and the Empire State Plaza Welcome Center right here in Albany has eclipse glasses that they give out to people who are in the area to see the eclipse.
All right. This is from Peter in Cranford, New Jersey. Why is it that an indoor temperature in winter feels colder than a summer indoor temperature? For instance, when it's 72 degrees inside the house in winter, I still wear a fleece. But when it's 72 degrees in the summer inside the house, I'm comfortable in a short-sleeve shirt. Isn't 72 72 no matter how you slice it? And that's from Peter in Cranford, New Jersey.
Because of the moisture content.
Really?
Absolutely.
I agree with Peter. I mean,
it
does.
The other way.
Well, it does. It senses that body feels cooler or warmer based on its ability to retain the heat because of the moisture in the air.
Hmm. Yeah, when it's humid, you can get rid of heat by evaporation less well. And there's a good dose of psychology in this,
yes,
too, I think.
Yeah. You know, they keep it at about 73 in the newsroom, which I find intolerable.
Too hot?
Way too hot.
Yeah.
It's not air conditioning. Unless it's 70 or less, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, you shouldn't have the heat up that high.
Well, right now my heat at home is at 58.
Nice.
Sleeping in 58 is lovely. In fact, when it gets to be 70 in the summertime, it's too hot. Like, yes, I strip all the blankets off except for that thin one, but it's still too hot. I need a cold bed.
Yeah.
So
temperature and dew point.
Yeah.
Okay, fair enough.
And you know how they measure that, right? What the instrument is they measure dew point with?
No. A wet bulb.
Sling psychometer.
Yes.
I'm sorry, what?
No. A sling psychometer.
Psychrometer.
Psychrometer.
Yes,
okay.
But what they use also is horsehair.
What?
Really?
Yes.
Okay.
Horsehair extends and contracts with humidity, and most of the old...
My head must be horsehair.
Yeah, that's what they use with the old hydrometers. Hydrometers, they would use a horsehair for it.
But a sling psychrometer,
psychrometer is
a temp. It's a wet bulb thermometer on the end of a string that they swing in a circle.
That is okay. I think I might be having some sort of some stroke or something here because everything seems a little odd. This is from Rich, our buddy Rich, who does the bird show. You
mm-hmm.
know Rich?
Rich? We know Rich.
Rich Guthrie and all?
Yeah. Yes.
King Arthur's Court is the subject heading. Mm-hmm. The Connecticut Yankee saved his life by knowing that there was going to be an eclipse. How did they predict eclipses back then?
Well, exactly the same way they do it now. It's 18 years, 11 and one-third days. The trick with that, that was a solar eclipse, correct?
Yeah, he had an almanac with him.
Yes.
I think it was Poor Richard's almanac that he had with him when he transported back in time, and it had given all of the historical eclipses. So it was looking backwards in time.
Oh, so he was cheating.
He was cheating.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, but he, you know, that's the way you save your life when you're going to be beheaded.
Well, so the trick, Rich, is to go back in time and have a book with you. That's the real trick.
Christopher Columbus saved his life because of an eclipse.
Huh?
The West Indies, when he landed there, the people there were so mad at him for having taken one of their kings, effectively, the last time he'd been there, that they were trying to kill him. So they made a barricade around him so that his crew couldn't get out. And he knew there was going to be a lunar eclipse, and he told them that the moon was going to rise red with wrath. And they saw it and said, well, okay, maybe you do know something. So they let him go, and he went back to Spain, yeah.
All right, so one more question, and good heavens, I believe it's another geology question. No wonder I'm having trouble believing this is reality. We've had so many geology questions. This is from... Hambone, apparently. Yeah. Years ago, while visiting my father, he showed me not one but two rocks he had. He's been gifted these rocks years and years ago, I believe from Arizona. They remind me of another rock. I can't quite remember the name of that. I know it's used to be put on each knee, and there's a healing property, I guess. Now these rocks, he had one was on a tray, sort of round, and he could knock. what appeared like ash off of it. The other was in a box, and when he opened the box, the thing had grown to fill the entire box. I've not been able to figure it out. Was this anything remotely like it? I have no idea what I just read. Ed, over to you. Over to you.
Wow. If it came from Arizona or that area, what it might have been is a bentonite.
Okay.
Which is effectively a volcanic ash that, when it gets wet, expands. And that's the only reason I can see for a rock getting bigger.
Okay, that makes sense. Okay,
because, of course, New York is wet with humidity. That's our theme for today.
Right. That's a possibility for it. That's the only possibility I can think of it right off the top of it. It's actually called Mount Marillonite is the material. And they feed it to chickens at times to make the chickens smell better.
Lovely.
Mm.
That's just another point.
Now, isn't there a historical, isn't there history where people were taking slightly radioactive rocks and using the inherent warmth that came out of the decay that was in the rock as a, like a kind of a soothing way to deal with arthritis and so on?
I'll tell you, if it was warm enough, it was something you want to be anywhere near.
I know. I mean, it was a terrible mistake, but I think I've read that in the past, that there were pseudoscientists who were making commerce out of these rocks in the much ancient past to be able to say, hey, these will warm your bones. And, of course, they were irradiating.
Oh, boy.
Cool.
All right. Well, what could go wrong? Let's go back to the phones. 800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum. Roger Jaboney, Barbara Brabets, Jim Pickett, and Ed Stander. And Let's go to Johnstown. Chris, you're on.
Hey, guys. Thanks a lot.
You bet.
I read online recently on the internet, so, of course, it probably has to be true.
Absolutely.
they were talking about the eclipse and the sun, and the author mentioned that the scientists really don't know the diameter of the sun. If they can predict galaxies that are light years away, and I don't know if this fact is true or not. That's why I'm calling.
Okay.
If it is, why can't scientists know the diameter of the sun when they can predict light years away from galaxies and stars?
Well, actually, they do know the diameter of the sun. Captain Cook actually went around the world to take the measurement of the diameter of the sun way back then.
How do you do that?
You do it through looking at the transit of Venus. As Venus goes across the sun, you start when it's on one side of the sun and when it ends at the other side of the sun, and the amount of time it takes, knowing the size of the distance of Venus to the sun, you can determine the size of the sun from that.
Huh.
Yeah. I think perhaps what the scientists were trying to say is that there's different ways to measure the diameter or circumference of the sun, because there are different layers of the sun. In the same way that you could say, what's the diameter of the Earth? Is it at a sea level? Is it at the top of Everest? Is it at the top of our atmosphere? Like, where does the definition of the outside exist? I could see where that is up for debate. It certainly isn't unsure. It would be that there's different answers to that question depending on where you call the outside.
The outside of the sun. You know, there's a lot of activity going on the surface of the sun. So you've got this big ball of plasma
bubbling,
doing its thing on the surface.
Yeah.
So it depends on how close is good enough for measuring the diameter of the sun. If you want to know it to the nearest centimeter, you're not going to do that.
Yeah, as a ball of gas, the gas is going to expand and contract at times, depending on how hot the sun actually is.
Yeah.
All right, Chris, thanks a lot for the call. And let's now go to Elijahville. And Bill, you're on.
Good afternoon, young people. The question's real quick. I just, the thought occurred to me. I had heard about looking at the reflection on a lake or a pool of water. Would you be able to see without harming yourself on the reflection?
Oh, that's an interesting idea.
But the other part was, and you can answer both, is if I took a mirror outside, laid it on the ground, would I be able to view at an angle the eclipse?
No, I wouldn't recommend either of those methods.
Interesting. Why?
Well, because the water will reflect probably about 4% of the light that's coming in, and that's way too much.
Now that's interesting, because if you go to the ocean or you go to the lake and it's a sunny day, you look at the lake, the sun sometimes reflecting on it, and it, you know, we've all looked
well,
at
and,
it.
And you can't look if it's really calm. You can't look at the direct reflection of the sun for very long, because it is
okay.
So bright.
Fair enough.
And certainly a mirror is not a good idea. But
right. I mean, if you think about like snow blindness, that's actually just a reflection of sunlight off of a glossy surface like snow or ice. And what you end up doing is giving a sunburn to your retina, and you can do permanent damage there, too.
All right. What do you think, Bill?
Well, guess what I'm not doing.
Thank you for the call. And to Rensselaer, Rich, you're on.
Hi. I'd like to know if we'll be able to see Mercury during the eclipse, and if so, which direction?
You should actually be able to see Mercury. The Mercury will be to the right of the sun and very low, should be a little bit higher in the horizon.
It will be bright enough?
It should be bright enough, yeah, at the time of the eclipse. You'll also be able to see, supposedly, you'll also be able to see a comet, which will be right near Jupiter, which is on the left side of the sun at about the same height as the sun.
Okay, now I've read that, just what you said, and I asked Bob Berman about it last week, and he said, no, it won't be bright enough. But I've seen in a couple of things online, and of course, again, online is always right, that, yeah, you might be able to see that.
Well, the trick is that it's going to have an apparent magnitude of about 5, which is right at the ability of the eye to actually see it anyway.
Yeah.
But with a pair of binoculars, when the sun is completely covered, if you look over towards Jupiter, you may be able to see it.
I'll tell you, you know, Rich, thanks for the call.
It's a busy 4 minutes.
Yeah.
You got a lot to look at.
The thing is, this is what scares me. It's that people looking too long without the glasses or with binocs.
These are the same people who drive in traffic. You know this, Ray, right?
What do you mean?
Like, I mean, We intermingle with these people all the time. They're driving in cars that can kill us all the time. So their decision-making is what's going to decide their fate.
But I'm just concerned that we'll have an epidemic of eye issues after this big, much ballyhooed eclipse. Why are you laughing, Roger?
Our society has become so hypersensitive and hyper-cautious. You know, between bacteria and viruses.
I'm not worried
about eclipse
that.
Has been around for 100 million years.
Okay.
And people have lived through it. We're here to talk about it.
A lot of people had bad eyesight for a long time. Right. What are you trying to say?
Right.
Yeah, I don't think there was much of an epidemic of that after the last one. What was that, 2017?
It was 2017, yeah. Not that I saw.
Just be careful. That's all, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, just be careful. Yeah,
our legal department wants me to tell you to be extremely careful.
Right.
Doesn't it hurt? Don't I have a pain threshold?
No.
If I'm going to stare at this thing? Yeah, it's not going to hurt.
No.
Somebody asked me, what about my pets? And it's like, well, your pets don't normally stare at the sun, so I think they're going to be fine.
The one thing which would truly be dangerous is if you're screwing around with binoculars and happen to
catch it even for a second.
Yes.
Yeah.
You don't want to do that.
And a pair of eclipse glasses are about one something. So they're not very expensive.
By the way, we talked about the temperature in the house and everything else. And this is an interesting one from Gracie. Same temp in the winter, summer. The reason we feel colder in the winter is because our feet are at floor temp and 10 degrees colder. What do you think, panel?
Except at Ed's house. He has in-floor heating, which is lovely. Yeah, I do think there's something to that.
No, definitely.
I think she's right. I think she's right. The writer is right.
Okay.
It's just like if you're cold, you go outside, you put a hat on because you lose most of the heat through your head. But if you're on a floor that's cold, it's going to affect your whole body. Mm-hmm. No question.
Absolutely.
All right. We have about 30 seconds left. Let's go to Stephanie in Red Hook. We'll clear the plate here. Stephanie, go ahead. You got to go quickly.
Yes. Piggybacking off that question. When you're not in a home consistently and it's in the dead of winter, what temperature should you leave your thermostat on? Because you worry about freezing at 32, and if you leave it at 50, you should be fine, right? Is there a temperature that's ideal for that?
It depends to some extent where your pipes are. If your pipes are in your basement and you're heating the upstairs, then you have a problem no matter what. So it really depends on where your pipes are. And I might mention that the place that really has a problem with that is where the pipe comes into the house. Because if you have, for example, a spigot on the outside and you close it, then very often you'll get ice forming right at that location.
Uh-huh.
So You can leave it at 50, but again, the pipe should be kept at least above 35.
All right, Stephanie, we got to leave it there. Did you want to add something?
Oh, I just wanted to say sometimes the piping's in the outside walls of your house, and when it's windy and cold, that's the worst time.
All right. Well,
if you live with my wife, who says that it's below 70, the bird is cold. So you don't want the bird to be cold.
You want to know something? You made it through the whole show, and now the last thing you said will get you divorced. That's a terrible thing. Roger Jaboney, thank you for being here. Jim Pickett, Ed Stander, and Barbara Brabets. Thanks to the science panel. Thanks to everybody who called in. Support comes from Old Songs Concerts, Orkney fiddler and photographer Louise Bichen from Scotland to Canada with Ethan Sitiawan Connor and Brendan Hearn this Friday, 7:30 p.m., live and streaming, concerts.oldsongs.org. The odds of me actually getting any of those names right? About 2%. Also, Rural Schools Association of New York, committed to alerting New York's rural schools, communities, state and federal leaders to the local impacts of legislation, budget, COVID response, and more, rsany.org. Once again, thanks to the science panel for being here. Thanks to Nathan Scheid, who screened the calls. Thank you, sir. Thanks to Zachary Malloy, our somewhat gruff engineer. Tomorrow on Food Friday, we'll welcome four brewers and we'll talk about beer with you. We'll see you too.